Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Raw here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we are pogoing about in association with AllFootballShirts.com. Well then, another week and another refereeing controversy, and it has many of us wondering, just where do you draw the line? The draw at Everton was another point to the total, but should it have been all three? All eyes now then on our trip to Amsterdam to face Ajax in the Europa League. Since they were beaten at the Amex, they've changed their manager again and have won their last two and will be hungry to get into us. But could that play into our hands? The fun doesn't stop in the Netherlands though, as we are quickly back into league action with Sheffield United visiting the Amex on Sunday. Joining me today is, as ever, Alan Wares, and we are delighted to welcome back Tom Hyland. And later on, we will hear from a true Albion legend in the shape of Hans Cray. Now, Tom, do you remember Hans Cray?
He's a bit before my time, actually, AD.
That's it. Make us feel old. Having said that, AD, I think we've heard the recording. It is 40 years ago since he joined. 40 years.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem that long ago to me, but, you know.
Then... it's closer to the end of World War II than it is to now.
So, Tom, how's your Albion mojo? It's been a little bit up and down the last couple of weeks. We're not necessarily getting the wins our performances have necessarily deserved, maybe.
No, but, you know, I think we're plodding along. We're still picking up points. If our rough patch of the season is picking up the point away and at home, then, you know, we're going to be in good stead going into the second half of the season. But, you know, just need that little stroke of luck, need some players to come back from injury and get through the Europa League, really. That's the main focus for me, I think. No, because we'd have had the League Cup as well, we're not in. You know, that's modern football. You've got to play the competitions that are in front of you, and the fact that we've been rotating the squad so much, you know, the players should be fresh enough.
Well, it's also not just the players that are fresh enough, it's those that are left, those that are still standing. And I mean, as we're recording this, I was just watching, what was his name? Maxwell. I want to say Glenn Maxwell. Was it Glenn Maxwell? Just basically broken, single-handedly destroy Afghanistan, not in the Taliban sense, but in the Cricket World Cup. It's who's left standing, and like I say, hopefully we'll have some of our walking wounded returning to action, including social media seems to be getting excited about Jakob Modder. That'll be a kind of almost like a new signing, frankly. It obviously depends on how well he can actually get up to speed with De Zerbi ball, which, you know, he's not yet experienced in the Premier League.
I think the other thing to add as well is actually our fixtures over the last month or so haven't been the most simple fixtures. You know, we've been playing good teams. Even Everton at the weekend, they've won 5 out of their last 7 before playing us. That's a good point away from home, going up there at that point. And I think we've got to remember that actually the teams that we're playing, they're good, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, let's get into the nuts and bolts of this, because we've got a lot to get through today. So Everton, it was all change again. 4 of them, in fact, with Verbruggen, Van Hecke, Veltman and Gilmour all in. Tom, how did you see the game?
A lot of huff and puff, but we didn't really blow the house down. So that's kind of been the last few weeks, really. Lots of possession. I mean, what was it, 80%, just over 80% possession on Saturday. Mm-hmm. A lot of it around the edges of the box, but just couldn't get anything really killer into the penalty area for our strikers to finish. Not helped by Gross, Sky in it, and a couple of other chances going away.
Do you think, I mean, I've just been watching the highlights again today, and
boy,
I know, well, you know, you have to do it. And, you know, I'm just watching it. Sometimes it's just a decision-making, that you know, overthinking, taking an extra touch, not taking the shot when it comes up. I mean, it's easy to say when you're watching it on the screen, of course, and you're not necessarily seeing the same as you are on the grass. But, you know, I was just looking at it, and Pascal was There was a couple of times where he could have taken a shot early on and he didn't.
I think maybe the players had a similar view to what I had at Goodison, where I could see barely anything.
That is the standard view of Goodison.
Exactly. I had that problem as well.
But I think also when you're playing a team that's just sitting back, I mean, the space that we want to play into just isn't there. So it's that challenge of, it's not what the players are expecting or used to playing, so they have to find another way. And I think we're just a little bit too slow at finding teams out over the last couple of games.
Well, I think that actually what you've got there is that clearly De Zerbi has had a pre-season, and there's elements of the game that he's trying to play that have improved. For the most part, our first halves this season have been, I'm not going to say poor, but they've been clumsy and a bit careless. Second half, I don't know what it is he says to them at halftime. You just think, can't you say this to the same thing to them at the beginning of the game? And of course, it doesn't work that way because you still have to work out how you're going to play what's put in front of you.
Mm.
But I think you've also got to consider the quality of the players that we do have at our disposal. And I do go back to this. It's not to say we haven't replaced Caicedo and McAllister, but when you've got those two players, you realise, I think it's obvious for all to see, something I think we all knew, but are now getting to see it, as to just what amazing quality players they were. That's not to say Dahoud can't do the job, that Gilmore can't do it, that Lallana can't do it, but there was that something, that little bit extra. And I think that maybe even with top tout in the early days ahead of De Zerbi. So it's all about those players that we've got. And I think we had this discussion last week, AD, with Stephen Grant when he was on, and he made some very, very pertinent points about the fact that it's not a season of consolidation. It can't be, because we're in Europe. But we're not going to make the same strides this year that we did last year. And so we've got to realise that if we are going to get better, then that learning curve is flattening out a little bit. And then once we've had those players that have been embedded for a year, then hopefully next season they can kick on again. So we're not poor per se. It's just, I think we were a little bit spoiled in comparison with what we had last season.
Yeah, Tom? I think one of the big things that was evident on Saturday was Lamptey, Fatty and Dahoud coming on. They just were a lot more direct and willing to drive through that Everton team a lot quicker rather than pass it around to move forward. And I think that gave us a lot more impetus, and that's where it kind of, that pendulum shifted into our favour, that eventually kind of brought that lovely lovely deflection off of Ashley Young, and over Jordan Pickford of all goalkeepers. I mean, what a combo to have.
Absolutely.
But it was actually, I mean, you mentioned him there, that it was the ball from Dahoud out to Mitoma, who was strangely lonely. I mean, he'd been having a lot of fun, particularly against Ashley Young, and he was twisting his blood on a regular basis. And,
I reckon Mitoma meant that. I reckon he aimed for Ashley Young's heel in order that it went flying over Pickford, because Mitoma is that good.
Yes, that is.
I'm going to stick with that, and then yeah, I'm going to put that bottle of gin down.
Okay, well, I mean, obviously Everton did take an early lead, and there were early warning signs there. Decore stung the palms of Berukan from an almost identical position to where the goal was scored from, and it was a deflection off Dunk that took Mikhailenko's shot in. But I mean, you know, there was a couple of bites of the cherry, and that side was looking, they obviously targeted it.
I'm looking at a little bit once again of naivety from Van Hecker. I thought he was a little bit lackluster in the goal. Now, Van Hecker is one of those players he's gone from having one game in three to being a bit iffy to he's improved this one game in five or one game in six or half a game in five. I thought that his marking for the goal in the build-up to that was sorely lacking. And I'm sure that he's also, as I understand it, the angriest man in Lancing. And I think that he'll probably be beating himself up over that, knowing full well what he could or should have done about it.
I'm not sure about him being the angriest man in Lansing.
Well, according to his teammates,
he used to live in Art Lansing, Al. You should know this.
Well, let's put it this way. I wouldn't fancy standing on the receiving end of Van Hecker's irie on a dark night in Lansing. Let's put it that way.
Okay, well, let's address the elephant in the room and where you draw lines from and everything. I mean, I know what you think, Al, already, so we'll come to you second. But, sure. Tom, what are your thoughts on this?
So my immediate thought when they flashed up the image in the stadium was, surely they've drawn that on the wrong player because it showed a visible gap. The lines weren't overlapping. It looked like it was quite away. Offside by what they showed in the stadium. I was like, surely that's got to be on the wrong player because there's no way he was that far off on the replays. I mean, can argue whether it's right or wrong. PGMOL say it's the right decision, whatever. But frankly, the big thing is, how can the elite football league in the world be using the most pixelated images off of dodgy feeds and cameras that are running at a set frame rate that the ball is like half a meter away from the foot on the freeze frame that they're using, and then they're having to guess where the sleeve is or the armpit or the elbow or the hand or whatever it is they're measuring off. I mean, it's just ludicrous that that's the technology we're using for this. I mean, I still struggle how goals like that get disallowed, because it's finding a reason to disallow a good goal when actually all we want to see is goals scored. It's such a negative way to officiate the game, and I think it's wrong. Yeah. I'm still struggling to see how they've measured it from the right place.
It is basically them thinking that, is there any reason not to give it rather than is there any reason to give it? It's exactly that.
I'm just wondering about this mindset. I mean, frankly, I mean, on the back of what Tom's saying and what we've seen, it's just not good enough. This is a multi-billion pound industry. The English Premier League is a multi-billion pound industry. And you've got an antiquated stadium like Everton's. Now, don't get me wrong, people love these old school stadiums. They're having a new one built. Good for them. About time. That thing is bloody dangerous. But they've got a very low down camera focused on about the penalty area. As I understand it, they're supposed to have at least two camera angles, because let's face it, if there was an offside that was supposed to be decided on the halfway line or 10 yards, even 10 yards inside the half, they've got no chance of being able to adjudge that. If that's their offside camera angle.
To be fair, the cameras are meant to be calibrated to take into account all of the angles and stuff. But it's still just the way that they have to then mark based off of pixels that are...
They've zoomed in quite a way. And it shows that the original wide angle is actually very wide indeed. So by the time they've zoomed in... Now, if, for instance, the linesman had raised his flag, thinking it was offside, there's no way it would have been overturned to say... Because from that detail in itself, you cannot give a judgment. There is no judgment to be had because the pixel image is so poor. The line, this is exacerbated by the fact that the line we can clearly see was drawn in the wrong place. It's on Lewis's forearm. It should be on his... It's not even his sleeve. Forget the whole thing with the sleeve. Can you just
confirm where exactly the line should be drawn from? Because there is... Sure, some people say shit from the sleeve, some people it's from the armpit.
No, it's the bottom of the armpit. I put up a graphic, which is from IFAB. They changed it at the beginning of last season. They haven't changed it this season, but it's from... So it's effectively, in a nutshell, it's your shoulder. It's not your upper arm. Your upper arm is handball. Your shoulder, and it's as far down as the bottom of your armpit goes. But what was clear, the only thing that was clear... is that the line wasn't level with that. Now, it could be that if they'd have put the line in the proper place and put it at the bottom of his armpit, it might still have been offside. Great. But from that metric, that VAR is not in a position to give a correct decision by putting the line in the wrong place. You cannot do it from a poor quality image, and you cannot do it from the moment that the ball, the moment after the ball was kicked. There are three things there that actually say you cannot give a decision, in which case you go with the on-field decision, and if the flag was up, you go with the offside, and if there's no flag, you go with a goal. It's not difficult.
The thing with all of these is they're working down to the nearest millimetre, and that takes absolutely zero respect for any margin of error in the technology, which there is margins of error because it's not a completely, you know, real-time frame rate. There's going to be movement both ways in all of that, and you can't get the exact moment a ball's kicked.
And frame rate.
Exactly.
And
you can't, therefore, go down to a millimetre and say, yeah, it's 100% offside, because you've got that margin of error in it. And they even need to look at it and go, you know, we'll go to the on-field decision like they do with cricket when it's too close to call, or just scrap the lines, go down the route of the MLS and just have the VAR official look at it by eye and go, is it clearly offside? No, it's not. Stay with what was called on field.
That's too simple, Tom. That's too simple. Stop talking sense.
I mean, that's the point of VAR, isn't it? It's a video assistant referee, but in doing what they're doing, it's a video additional referee. And that's not what their remit is. Their remit is to actually work out whether there's a clear... And I suppose that what they're trying to do is make it a factual thing rather than a consideration thing. Like, for instance, are you looking at a penalty? You know, a handball? You know, and we've talked obviously a lot about the Luton game, the opening game of the season. You know, should that have been given as a penalty? It's a bit more subjective. In theory, offside is supposed to be more factual. However, if you don't... VAR was supposed to be there to eradicate human error. But all the while humans are using it, there's going to be error. And that's the irritating thing is that it's not the notion itself. I don't disagree with the notion of VAR itself. I disagree with the poor quality with which it's being administered.
Yeah, it's the micromanaging, Tom.
But I think that is also just officiating in general in this country at the moment at the professional level. I mean, they've obviously wanted to try and be more transparent by broadcasting very selective clips of VAR and the communication. But I can't be the only one that sits there, watches these clips and feels like it's even worse. Because actually hearing them talk just is like, they have no proper method of communication between each other, and it's chaotic.
Well, that method, that thing that we had with Liverpool against Spurs, where the audio was released, if we'd have heard that in the stadium, as opposed to the way of doing it in rugby or the way of doing it in cricket, if we would have listened to that, no one would have been any the wiser, and everyone was going, well, what happened there? What on earth were they on about? Yeah, mate, you're right. Yeah, go with that. You know, just even if it's robotic protocols of saying, you know, a goal has been scored, my on-field decision is offside, please clarify that. Don't even check clarify one way or the other, and they check it. And what you don't have in the background, you turn off the fourth official, you turn off the linesman unless their opinion is required, you turn off the assistant VAR unless they're... So you hear two voices, the on-field referee, the VAR person, and it's the conversation between the two where they've got stated protocols. That way you have absolute clarity and you eradicate ambiguity in the way that rugby can and the cricket can. With football, it's like a chat between two blokes down the pub who can't agree on anything.
Yeah. I mean, I do find it a little bit strange that this one, I mean, it's quite an egregious decision. I'm quite surprised that it's got lost in the mix. Obviously, the Arteta's headline making, moaning stuff about the Arsenal decision where they had three attempts to get it right, but I'm still not sure if any of those were. But there are other decisions this weekend as well, so I guess maybe it's just got lost. But okay, well let's just draw a line under that. It's another point to the title, and we move on to Amsterdam. But you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. And as ever, we are brought to you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com. And Phil has given us an interesting shirt to have a look at this week. Tom, do you want to have a go at describing this one for me?
Yeah, sure. It almost looks like a cricket shirt, if I'm being honest, rather than a football shirt. It's a white shirt with a kind of a diamondy zigzag pattern with an off-white on it. It's made by a well-known brand called Masita, and it has a nice big purple Rizla sponsorship. There's no crest. There's no clues. Where on earth could this be from?
Where else? Where in the world do they smoke? That is...
Exactly.
Yeah. I'll tell you what the material reminds me of. It looks like a bridal gown.
Just a bit, yeah.
Can I take a guess here? If only because I might recognise it from the colour of the advertiser, and I think who the advertiser might be. May I guess that it's an away shirt of Fiorentina?
You would be absolutely incorrect in that assumption. And this is what Phil has to say about this particular jersey. So this is your shirt of the week. Of course it is. This is the 1992-94 away shirt of the Belgian Challenger Pro League side, Konica Beerschot Voetbal Club Antwerpen, generally simply known as Beerschot. They're originally formed in 1921, the year after the Olympic Games, which gave the name to their home ground, which is the 12,500 capacity Olympisch Stadion in the Zwantes suburb of Antwerp. Several financial issues over the years means they've had half a dozen different variations on the name, and the current incarnation being established is just in 2013. The club is owned by Abdullah bin Mossad Al Saud. He also owns Sheffield United, Kerala United in India, Châteauroux in France, Al Hilal in Dubai, and all of whom he bought in 2020. Their nickname means nothing to me. It's the Purple White Army. I guess their home shirts aren't blue then. A few links to the UK include Toby Alderweireld, who was a youth player at Beerschot. He went on to play for Southampton and Spurs. Moussa Dembélé started his career with Beerschot. He went on to play for Fulham and Spurs. Yang Vertonghen, there's a link here, isn't there? Also started his career at Beerschot. And guess what? He went on to play for Spurs too. So did Victor Wanyama. So it's all a little bit too Spursy for Phil. Of course, though, there is a link to the Albion. The £110 million man, Moises Caicedo, played on loan from Brighton at Beerschot in the 21-22 season. So thank you for that, of course, Phil. You can see that and over 130,000 other shirts over at oldfootballshirts.com. It's well worth a few minutes of your time. Now, Al, last week on the show, we had a competition to win a copy of John Bradshaw's book, Grins, Lins and Limbs.
That's easy for you to say.
Yep.
No, ask the question if you want to in order to win a copy of the book, a signed copy, I believe it is. I simply asked, how many league goals, Premier League goals last season, did Brighton score before an Englishman did? And the answer is 19. It was Adam Lallana scored the 20th against Wolves. I also gave you a subtle hint about the fact that we actually had that question on Top of the Pods, which was the quiz we had at the end of last season. I'm delighted to say that Daniel Buttress, an occasional slash maybe regular but lovely listener, has won that copy of that book. Daniel will be in touch with you, but congratulations on winning John Bradshaw's book.
Absolutely. Now, of course, depending on when you're listening to this, if you listen to this on Wednesday, see you tomorrow. If you're listening to this on Thursday, sorry, you've missed it. If you're listening to it for Saturday, where were you? But of course, we have a show in Amsterdam ahead of the game at Ajax on Thursday. I will be at the Amsterdam Comedy Cafe along with last week's guest, Stephen Grant. And we're putting a wonderful show there. Come along. Tickets are still available. There may even be a few left on the...
From memory, AD, isn't it near Amsterdam Central Station? Only a 5-minute walk.
Yes, it is. And apparently it's the cheapest beer in the area.
But that's better still.
I don't know how expensive the area is, but from what I've heard, quite.
Well, but, to be honest, forget the comedy. That should be the deal maker.
It should be. But
because, as we all know, and I can say this with extreme confidence, Brighton fans do like a drink. 450,000 pints were sold at the Amex on match day last season. That's a big hangover.
Can you imagine what that would be if they didn't keep running out of Harveys?
Oh, it would be off the scale. It'll be off the scale. And yet, Harveys were there first. You know, I mean, as much as they want to put in Birra Moretti and Heineken, fine. You know, if that's the route you want to go, absolutely fine. But, you know, just stop running out of Harveys, people. It's rude.
Of course, Al, you're referring to the economic impact report that's just been released today. There's quite a few greatest hits in there, wasn't there?
The biggest headline I'm taking from it is the sort of near jocular hilarity with which, when the club was trying to justify the planning application for the stadium, they said about all the jobs that it will create and the benefit of the local economy. They said, oh, it'll be about £23 million annual benefit to the local economy. And they were laughed out of the room. Well, the headline figure from this report that's an independent financial study that's been made on Albion last season is that it brought in the benefits of around £612 million into the local economy. And that figure is set to increase this year by virtue of the fact that we're in Europe by anywhere between £30 and £80 million. So, yes, if anyone was in any doubt, I think you'll find that Brighton and Hove Albion are not just necessary for our mental health, but for the actual economy itself, is a good thing for the city. Yeah. And it makes all those who oppose the stadium and make their attitude in at that time absolutely all the more baffling.
But one of those things in there, it's like a... I mean, it's annoying for us, but it's great for the city. So I guess the city is the real winner here, isn't the fact that the games that get moved to a 5:30 or a later kickoff, it means basically like more people are coming and having to stay in the city and have
absolutely
great time.
For all the pain in the backside it is if Newcastle come down, and they do come down often for a 5:30 kickoff because TV decides that that's what Newcastle fans really like. But yes, they'll make a weekend of it. I mean, I would be of the opinion, and I have no hard and fast evidence for this, but obviously the biggest away following last season was, I'd imagine, the one weekend where the city cleaned up the most, as it were, and that's Grimsby Town, because they brought down more than a Premier League club would be able to do. They filled the place, and a lot of them made a weekend of it. It was effectively their cup final. It was a superb weekend for us. We won 5-0. We got to the semi-final. But it was a superb weekend for them, but more so brilliant for traders in the city. So, yeah, benefits all round.
And they had a great time in the city and they all went home with a haddock.
Not bad.
You know, you don't have to play 500-odd games for a club to be considered a legend. And that is certainly true of our guest today. In fact, he only played 23 times for the Albion, but those games that are etched into the memories of those who saw him due to his charisma and unorthodox style of play. The fact that this guy's gone on to have a very successful career in the media speaks volumes. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Hans Cray. Now, Hans, I grew up watching you. You're a hero.
Thank you very, very much for this fantastic introduction. Yeah, I only played 1.5 seasons for Brighton and 23 games. But I still regret that after 1.5 years, Chris Catlin, the manager, offered me to stay for another year. And that I got caught by a Dutch Premier League club. They said, what does Brighton offer you? I said, this is the amount and this is the signing on fee. And then they said, we do it for 5 years and you get a new car and you pay your house. And I made the biggest mistake. And until today, I regret that I signed for RKC Waalwijk in Holland, Premier League club. Sometimes at night, I think, Jesus, what an idiot. I've been to stay for 5 or 6 or 8 years in Brighton.
Yeah, I mean, you're remembered so well here, and it was just the way that you went around about your business, about not just on the football pitch but off it as well. I mean, we did a live theatre show with Chris Catlin a few years ago, and he had some interesting stories to tell about a certain Hansie Cray, as he likes to call you. And let's get into our time machine and go back to 1983. And you were playing back in Holland with Nac Breda. Yeah. And things got a little bit awry, should we say?
Yes, I got a suspension for 24 games. That is the longest suspension in history of Dutch football. I'm not proud of it. I totally disagreed with a referee that gave me a yellow card. It was a very windy game. And as soon as he gave me the yellow card, I gave him a little push. And he went through the air. And in the air, he changed the yellow card for the red card. And I can go to
suspension. That's tough trick to do that in the air.
I was really ashamed of it. But many people laughed about it. And they thought, oh, his hands, he doesn't mean it. We like him. But the people that are due into the suspensions, they didn't have any love for me. They said 24 games until the end of the season, you're suspended. And then I could go to Greece, to Panathinaikos for 2 years. But my manager said, you can also go on trial at Brighton. But I think we go for the money in Greece. I said, no, we go for the trial at Brighton. And so I came to Brighton and a month on trial. And after 2 weeks, Chris Kempton said, you stay here. We like the way you play.
Yeah. So how much did you actually know about Brighton before coming over here?
I watched the two games, the FA Cup final, because it was Brighton against Manchester United. And Arnold Muren was, I think, still playing for Manchester United. And I can remember that Gordon Smith, I don't hope he's listening to your program now.
He does, actually.
He does. Oh, he missed a big chance at 2-2 just before the end of the first final. And I played with Gordon. And all the time, wherever he was, Gordon Smith, Smudger, we called him, he always got remembered about missing that chance. He's had a horrible football life.
Yeah. He's had a brilliant football life, but he's still apologising for that now. I mean, he tells his story about when he went on to be the chief executive of the Scottish FA, and he went and sat in this room with all the other national executives, you know, and you had Platini, you had Beckenbauer, and he said, I'm the only person I didn't recognise in the room.
Oh God, he's a big officer now.
Well, no, he's not. He's not doing that anymore. But he was
okay.
He brought in a lot of special. He was the first person to bring in
the
punishment after the game, if you're seen to be diving. He was very much anti-diving, and basically he brought in a lot of ideas that have been carried through, which is probably a good thing, but you probably wouldn't have liked it back in the days when you were playing. Well, okay, so Chris Catlin offered you a trial with Brighton.
Yeah.
I mean, you had an interesting relationship with Chris?
Yeah, really. He's one of the two favorite managers I've ever had. He was so straightforward. He was so honest. He didn't have to explain players why they're not playing. They said, these are the best 11 players. And if you want to be by the in the lineup, make sure that you're better than those 11. And I don't have to explain you every week why I'm not playing and why he's not playing or why he's playing. So when I was playing, I was very, very, very happy because we played with Joe Corrigan. He came from Manchester City, the goalkeeper.
Mm-hmm.
The Steve Foster was a good friend of mine, the fantastic central defender at the midfield. When I played in the midfield, there was Jerry Ryan. He sadly passed away a few weeks ago at a very, very young age of 68. I'm very sorry for his family, because Jerry was a great colleague. Did I mention Jimmy Case already?
No. Well, I mean, you know, there's others in that scene. You're Tony Grealish, Jimmy Case, Frank Worthington.
Tony Grealish and Frank Worthington was my big friend. I was only 23. He was 37 already, but I had such a great time with Frank, and we were the total opposite. I was a hard tackling player, and he was an atypical striker in England. He did not like to head. He didn't like to make sliding tackles. Everything was with his perfect technique. And off the pitch, we quite often go to Rudy's for a drink together. And every now and then he phoned me up and said, Hans, Mick Jagger is over. Do you like to have a drink with us tonight? So but then we went to Woody's with Mick Jagger, Frank Worthington, and Hans Kraaij Jr. from Holland. And all the girls and all the pretty girls were around Mick Jagger. They were around Frank. And then at the end of the evening, they picked the best girl out and they said, this one is for you, Hans. And then I had a girl with pickle on her nose as big as a football game, the football ball, with a wooden leg. They always took the Mickey out of me, Frank. He always gave me the ugliest. He always took the biggest. And then he phoned up and said, Rod Stewart is here, let's go for a drink. And then the same story, I ended up with the most ugly one and they took Miss World home. Great time. And Frank even tried to bring me over to Tranmere Rovers when he became player manager there. So I stayed in contact quite a long time with Frank and his beautiful wife, Carol. Yeah. And he passed away as well.
So what did you make of Frank's dress sense?
Yeah, he always did wear a leather jacket with on the left side here with the Elvis Presley pin-up. He was such an atypical English football player. He hated everything, heading, no tackling, no fights. He wanted to have the ball on his feet, in his feet, over the ground. He hated long balls. He was so unbelievably good and great guy.
Yeah. And he loved a fedora, didn't he? It was like, he was certainly very, very unique. But like I said, like when Chris signed you, I don't know if you knew this or not, but you became the first continental player for the Albion in peacetime.
Oh, then they don't pick the right one, eh?
I think they did. Obviously, when you look at, majority of the teams back then were majority English, Scottish, or Irish. So to have someone to come in from the continent was exotic. It was new. It was like, and when you look at it now, it's more unusual to see an English player in the team. Actually,
it's unbelievable.
Did you have problems settling in? Obviously you had like the last Frank Worthington, like you said. It seems quite easy.
I didn't have any problems settling in. After the first training session, I didn't have any time settling in. I needed no time to settling in because after the first training session, Chris Kettering came up to me. You were from Holland, but we are used to tackles, but I'm a little bit scared that you are over tackling. I said, what do you mean? Yes, your tackles are very, very on the edge of yellow card or not yellow card. So he needed 3 weeks to tell me, slow down a little bit, Hans, before I got my debut at Brighton and Hove Albion out to Fulham. And he put me as a right fullback.
Yeah, that was on the 27th of December, 1983. Were Christmas games new to you? Because, you normally have the winter break in Holland, don't you?
Yeah, in Holland, we are always jealous at the Premier League, who were then playing at Christmas Eve, New Year's Day. In Holland, we don't play. You have to be with your mother-in-law. Not many people do like their mother-in-law at Christmas Eve and the New Year's Day. So we are in Holland. We look with a lot of jealousy towards the time that there was played in... Are they still doing it? Are you still doing it?
Yeah. I mean, the TV schedule's trying to move things around and ruin it for everybody. And it's like, one of the things that made you, endeared you to the Albion faithful was... A certain little routine that you had. I mean, how did the pogoing come about?
You mean with the corners?
Yeah.
That's your question?
Yeah, so you're jumping up and down in front of the keeper. I mean, I understand that Chris Catlin said to you, Hans, make yourself a nuisance at corners.
Yes, he told me once... sometimes you make me panic in the dugout. Can you make with corners? Can you make the the opposite team and the goalkeeper and the defenders in panic instead of me. I said, okay, I think about it, boss. And then before Frank, he took the corners most of the time, especially from the right-hand side with his fantastic left foot. And then before he took it, and then he looked at me before I was ready, until I was ready with my routine, I was jumping up and down off the goalkeeper, and always touched him. And then the north stand were with thousands of them jumping up and down and heads. And when they started to call Hans is evil, Hans is evil, then I had to run down the penalty box. And then every now and then, two players followed me. And yeah, at Leeds United, Brighton Leeds United, they two central defenders bounced against each other and both were injured. And then the whole stadium was shouting, Hans is evil, Hans is evil. But I didn't know that they still know that song.
Yeah, well, it kind of got changed. I mean, Doug Ridley got it for a while, but it kind of regenerated. But it is certainly something that people are still very much aware of, and it is still in their arsenal, as it were. But okay, so 23 games. There's 3 goals in that time as well, and 2 red cards. I mean, that's quite some record, really.
Your record?
Your record, yeah.
I don't remember the red cards. I do remember the goals.
Well, I understand there's more red cards if you include the reserve games as well.
No, it was pretty nice to move to England, because in Holland, after 3 yellow cards, you got suspended. And in England, they had the point system. After 20 points, you got one suspension. So and a maximum for a yellow card was for a tackle 4 points. So it was paradise for me to play in England, because you rarely got suspended.
Okay, well, one of the things that also that I know that you very much enjoyed about our fair city was the nightlife, and I understand you were quite often seen on the Pink Coconut of a night.
Yes, I remember that. I don't know if I can tell this, but every Tuesday nowadays, it's absolutely not done and impossible. Every Tuesday, Steve Foster and Jimmy Kay said, if you want to be part of our team, if you want to be part of our squad, every Tuesday, we've got to go out with the entire team. And then we ended up at the Coconut. Was it the Coconut?
The Pink Coconut. Yeah, it's not there anymore, sadly, but it's, yeah.
Yeah, and then that was most of the time. Well, 12:30, 1 o'clock. And then I remember that Jimmy Case said, come on, crazy Hans, we order some more wine. And then he said, fuck the glasses, bring the bottles. And I always had to drive Jimmy home. And every now and then his wife kept him sleeping in the garden.
Yeah, apparently there's a rumor that particularly after one night at the Pink Coconut, that you went in to see Chris Catlin the next day and asked for the next day off. Is this true?
No, apparently
you met somebody.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, that's right. I met my wife, my first wife. I say that with a lot of respect, Jill. She was a waitress. And I met her, and Frank Worthington was telling me the night before the day I met her, he said, the waitress is looking at you all the time. And then every time that I was looking at the waitress, she did not look at me. So at the end of the evening, I started to believe in Frank's words. And he said, why don't you go over and ask her for a date? So I went over to her and I said, you've been looking at me all night. Shall we go out tomorrow? And she said, first of all, I did not look at you once. Second of all, I don't like footballers. And third of all, you're totally not my type. I thought, this is my chance. And within a week, we got married. I was so unbelievably in love. So on a Monday night, on a Sunday night, I asked the boss, Chris Catlin, can I have the day off tomorrow? He said, what's happening? I said, I'm going to get married. And are you engaged? And he said, no, I met her a week ago. So it was a very, very strange story. But Jill from Brighton her father and mother were diehard supporters, went to every away game, every home game, so they were quite excited. I got a very beautiful daughter from her, Mel. She's living in Cardiff now, but Jill is still living in Brighton, so she'll listen to this. And Jill, thank you very, 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 very much for a fantastic daughter we have together.
Okay. Well, let's fast forward it to now. Alan's just joined us as well. Obviously, the Albion are in a lot better place than we were when Ajax last won the European Cup. In fact, there's a stat that when Ajax were winning the last European Cup, the Albion were at, well, if you can call it home, at Gillingham, losing 3-0 to Barnet in the fourth division. And, you know, and look at this now, qualifying for Europe and playing against Ajax in Amsterdam in a competitive fixture. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's the world upside down. Brighton has been playing for the last 2 years fantastic continental football. They play a little bit like the build-up is from Pep Guardiola at Manchester City. But like you say, when it was Barnet against Brighton, Ajax was winning European Championship Cups. And I've said on ESPN, on television, when I do the analysis of the Eredivisie, I said last week, I said, it's the world upside down. Normally, every team that plays against Ajax is happy to keep the defeat as low as possible. But this Ajax, 2 weeks ago, went to Brighton and had so unbelievably a lot of respect for the Serbian football and for Brighton that they started the game with the attitude, I don't hope we get hammered with 5 or 6-0. It's a big shame. It was a big shame. That game was the lowest that Ajax has ever been in history. I couldn't believe my eyes. It's not that Brighton was that impressive, because they're struggling as well. The last 8 games, they've won 1. And that's against Ajax.
Yeah, I mean, the results haven't been necessarily as good as the performances. I mean, with De Zerbi has been changing it around, trying to balance the team and the league. And you know, a lot of the time, particularly in the earlier phases of this competition, we're probably playing the occasion rather than the game, which is something we see on here quite a lot. And we're actually, I think that game against Ajax, we kind of came of age. We didn't really have to get out of second gear. And let's not forget, this is one of the worst Ajax teams in history. I mean, up until that game, they were 17th in the league. They went to bottom of the league. But they've obviously just won the last two. They won 4-1 at the weekend, was it? So
yeah, 4-1.
It's you know, so the new manager's turning things around, and I think it'll be a very different game at the Amsterdam Arena on Thursday.
There's a new manager. Yeah, it definitely will be a totally different game, because the Ajax supporters, it's a sellout. Every game is a sellout of Ajax in our Premiership, and at other games it's always a sellout in at the moment. But the 50,000 Ajax supporters won't accept the way Ajax plays at Brighton. They definitely won't accept it. There's a new manager, John van Schip. He played 327 games for Ajax. He's got the Ajax attitude. He's got the Ajax feeling. And we all expect, and especially the Ajax supporters, that Ajax plays offensive, dominant, build-up football with high pressure. And nothing... really nothing the Brighton supporters, the Ajax supporters, the people in Holland that watch television have seen that at the Brighton Albion game. Even after 2-0 for Brighton, it was a scary team. And in 10-15 days, John van Schip is slowly getting the Ajax system back in the team. So yes. Brighton, be prepared. They won't be as scared as 2 weeks ago.
You see, that's when the draw was made, that's the one fixture that I thought that actually Brighton would have the best chance at is Ajax away, because of the culture and the history and the I hesitate to use the phrase, but the DNA of of the club over the past 50, 55 years is that they play that offensive, technical, high-press match. And that is actually the kind of opponent that Brighton prefers to have. It's the,
I know.
Like I said, the game that you saw against Ajax, where they rarely came out, they were timid, it was almost felt sorry for the fact that I'm thinking it's like seeing giants, European giants, fallen. And it's not because they were playing Brighton, it's because they were scared of their own shadow. Now, if the manager is going to turn it around and play this more intense height, this is going to play into Brighton's hands. And this is the one fixture I was looking at. And I'm thinking, this is the one that maybe, just maybe, Ajax can fall into our trap. We play better against Man City. We play better against Liverpool. We play better against Manchester United. And if Ajax can actually get back to even something approaching who they are,
that plays into our game for them.
Better than them, yeah.
Well, on Sunday, Sunday morning, I've got my talk show on television. We've been talking about this, what the two of you are saying, for about 20 minutes. We know that when Brighton goes to plays Fulham, they defend. They only defend Fulham. Brighton doesn't like it. When Brighton plays Everton last weekend, Everton defends. And what Brighton likes, we know that the opponent is offensive. They put high pressure. They make the build up and they play from the pressure out and play the midfield in and have with fantastic football the counter attack. But still, we think there is no escape from Ajax. They won't be very defensive. They will have high pressure because the fans won't accept it. We won't accept it, the fans won't accept it, and if it's good for Brighton, that's a pity. Ajax will put the pressure on Brighton, and it will be a totally different game. But still, Brighton do have the better players.
Who are you supporting in this game, Ed?
Sorry?
Who are you supporting in this game?
Yeah, in Holland I say Ajax, but in your show, I say Brighton.
You enjoying sitting on that fence?
No, we on Sunday morning when we were discussing Brighton, every now and then someone said that we mustn't over respect it to Brighton. They play fantastic football, but if you don't win the last 7 or 8 games in the Premier League, it's the best league in the world. We know it. Then you don't have to be scared, and we will play offensively.
This is going to be fascinating. Like I say, one thing I do agree with is not going to be the same game as it was at the Amex. Because like I say, if I was a travelling Ajax fan, I'd be furious. I mean, we're picking up the messages of the people that we've done Ajax podcasts with. You know, we're seeing we could be a bit more forceful, a bit less timid. We could be playing this, and like I say, that was a kind of a second division side we were playing there that looked shot to pieces on confidence. I mean, I think probably in that case our best hope is that for all the work that's being done, it's still early days for it, and that it's still work in progress because. Not only was the tactics all over the place, I thought I detected a sense of disinterest as well.
Well, what do you mean with disinterest?
I thought they could have played a bit harder, played a bit more high tempo, played a bit with a bit more passion and a bit more sort of oomph about it. You know, there was an organisation of being defensive, but there was so little consideration to attack. It was, you know... Yeah.
Yeah. But at the moment, Steven Bergwijn, you will say that, is that a good name? Steven Bergwijn, who played for Tottenham.
The captain, former Spurs player.
Yeah, he was in a dip for quite a while. But since the new manager is there, Jovan Skip, he's got more freedom. He begins to look at the Steven Bergwijn we know in the Dutch national team and the way they paid £35 million for him to Tottenham. He's coming on. People get more confidence. We've got two Croatian internationals, Sutalo and Sosa, left fullback and central defender. They were disgusting. They were horrible the first 8 or 9 games. They are progressing. So the whole team is getting more confidence. And I think it will be a very hard night for Brighton. And I think the Ajax are the favourites.
Just one quick point I want to take up with something that Hans mentioned just now. I'm just wondering if you could sort of like put some more meat on this one. Is that it's a comment you said Brighton have the best players. Are you of the opinion that man for man that that Brighton have the superior players?
They got two good goalkeepers, Steele and Verbrugge. Better goalkeepers than we've got. I think Dunk is one of the best central defenders around. I'm very, very, very impressed with him. I'm quite impressed with Jean-Paul Van Hecke, especially the way he plays inside foot the balls into the midfield. He's been very, very, very in progress. Joel Veltman, more trustful, you can't get him. Mitoma, I'm a big, big, big fan of Mitoma. He's got everything that I'm jealous of. What a great dribbler he is. That will be a very scary night of the worst Ajax player. So, Gaia, a Scandinavian player, is bought for 8 or 9 million pounds. And in the youth teams, they've got much better players, Ajax. But Gaia, the worst Ajax player, got to play against Mitoma. Hopefully, for us, Divine Range is the first right fullback. Is fit enough to start. And otherwise, it's a great disaster. And what's happening with Fati? Because I'm a big, big fan of Fati. He doesn't always start.
It's called managing his minutes. Basically, he came here, he wasn't fully fit, and we're just building him back up. But he's getting more and more minutes as time goes by. And unfortunately, we're going to have to send him back to Barcelona at the end of the season as a better one that arrived here. But he's got all the tools to be a massive success here. And basically, as time goes by and his minutes increase, he's going to become much more important to us. And hopefully, that's going to happen on Thursday.
Yeah, under De Zerbi, very few players have actually been brilliant from day one. They've all had to have a little bit of breaking in.
Don't forget me, eh?
I wasn't aware you played under De Zerbi. Maybe you did.
Don't forget me.
No, we don't get that many red cards under De Zerbi, and so it's
only De Zerbi himself.
Right. But Hans, we're just about running out of time on the Zoom here. So just quickly, what does Brighton Hove Albion mean to you?
Together with my time at San Jose Earthquakes in America, when I played with when I was 19 years old, I played with George Best at San Jose Earthquakes. Was this the best time of my life? And I've endured every second of it, the 1.5 year I've been there. And I, every now and then, like I started with today with you, I wake up at night and say, what an idiot you've been that you choose for a 5-year contract for a very different club than Brighton. Brighton, I think about Brighton, Chris Kaplan, what a great manager. Frank Worthington, Steve Forster, Jimmy Case, what a great time, what a great supporters. And hopefully they forget me now.
No,
not a chance. Okay, and that is all we've got time for. So thank you to the ever brilliant Tom Hylands. Thank you to Alan Wears. Of course, thank you to Hans Cray. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast, and in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Thanks for listening, and we see you all again next week. Cheers. Bye. Ay, da, ay, da, ay, da.
Ooh.